This is John Floridis. Welcome to Grief and Mystery. A storyteller, a singer, and a band. An evening of mongrel sorrow dappled by magic and wonder, fringed with regard for the gift of the tongue, hearkening and hortatory, bardic and grain, steeped in mortal mystery. These nights have the mark of our time upon them, and they've become timely, urgent, alert, and with some swagger. They are nights devoted to the ragged mysteries of being human, and so grief and endings of all kinds appear. What would you call such a thing? We called it Nights of Grief and Mystery. And so begins the official description of a unique collaboration between author, teacher, activist, and farmer, Stephen Jenkinson, and musician, songwriter, and composer, Gregory Hoskins.
And you come to, you know, a silent stage, nobody knows what you're going to do, and you barely do yourself. And from that very unpromising beginning, you start carving in the air.
I mean, and you know, you don't know what you're going to say. I don't know what I'm going to play. And I don't know what I'm going to... I don't know how or when or if. When we start reaching for each other, that we can find each other.
Strangest thing, they granted me a visa and fully documented me in order to perform cognitive dissonance on the general public. So, that's what I understand Nights of Grief and Mystery to be. Cognitive dissonance for everyone.
Welcome, friends. For friends we may soon be. Friends are forged on a dark road, heading out of town. We're headed there now. And I welcome you to this cosmic constant of ours. Mystery days. Welcome to this exhortation of the ages. Welcome to that only single glory of your life that cannot age, that cannot fall down, that cannot wither. Welcome to that plea from all of your unsuspected kin trudging the lost nation road, even now. We're modern. God knows we are. We're modern. And we're homeless, and we are confused by freedom. And so we've left them to themselves, or to each other, or to God, as we ourselves seem to have been left, they say. Allow me to welcome you to the dust. The dust of uncertainty, and that stilled gaggle of opinion and of faith that is the ending of days. And welcome to your one true love that was wrangled from all those promises, all those betrayals, and all that octane of your younger days. And welcome to the catastrophe to that old road for going down, for slipping into the mystery days, plaited and braided for you by those who came before, whose wonder now made a path through the easy terrors and through the boredom without end into life, who loved being alive as much as any of us here now, and who died accordingly, and who angled not for Neverland, but for now.
Stephen Jenkinson is an activist, teacher, author, and farmer. He has a master's degree in theology from Harvard University and a master's degree in social work from the University of Toronto. He's a former program director and medical school assistant professor. He is the subject of the National Film Board of Canada documentary film, Grief Walker. Stephen also teaches internationally, and with Natalie Roy, Jenkinson founded the Orphan Wisdom School in 2010, which convenes in Tremor, Canada, and in various places in Northern Europe. He is the author of How It All Could Be, now translated into four languages, Money and the Soul's Desires, Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, and most recently, Come of Age, The Case of Elderhood in a Time of Trouble. Here's just a bit more of a taste of the collaboration of Jenkinson and Gregory Hoskins, a sample of a selection from the album Nights of Grief and Mystery called Narco Disbelief.
I'm in Mexico, I'm teaching in Mexico, and it's hot, something like this. And I was at a rich man's house. In fact, I was at a rich man's ashram, or whatever it was, a retreat center of some patchouli description. And it was funky in its way, but it was kind of money zen, as I've come to call it. You've probably seen the combination yourself. Money zen. So it was that, and it was Mexican to boot, so you combine that as you will. It sounds like the newest restaurant in town, actually, now that I think about it. And there I was, and I was sitting on this little patio, and there's the man in question, who might have been a drug lord, for all I could tell, and his three sisters, who'd only flown in from Mexico City 15 minutes before I got there. And the woman who insisted that we meet, her idea entirely, although she abandoned me to him almost instantly. And myself, and we sat there, and he would look over at me occasionally, as sort of hooded-eyed chameleon types can do. And then he'd look away and talk Spanish. And then eventually he swung over in his kind of gecko fashion, and he kind of looked at me sideways. He said, "So, what do you do?" That's the great crucifixion of idle chatter. So, what do you do? And if you fall for it, you'll answer. And then you'll feel obliged to fit in your rather massive biography into about 17 seconds of banter. If you fall for it. Well, I didn't that particular day. I was on my game. I did not fall for it. Although I did feel that I was under the gaze of this kind of a narco-funded situation. And for all of that, I said something in the order of, well, I just don't have a job, really. I drift about, and occasionally I'm troubled aloud, and some people seem to be compelled by that. And then the woman who brought us, she kind of gave me the prompt, like, say more than that, you know, you're up to it, you're making me look bad. And so I said, I just went back to her, over to you, since you seem to think this is a match made in heaven. So away you go. And she began to read the bio, more or less. which was a little embarrassing. And then she got to a place wherein she mentioned the dead. This was an interesting moment because his eyes really narrowed then. I thought they were closed, but they narrowed even more. And he leaned in, and he was about this far away from me, and he said, "The dead, eh?" Oh, he wasn't Canadian. "The dead, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, the dead." He said, "Well," he said, "if you believe in that kind of thing." Now, I must admit that temptation came to get me then. I'd resisted it until that moment, but I figured, you know, God works in mysterious ways, and this opportunity was one of them. So I leaned in ever closer still so that I could smell the aftershave. And I said to him, "Well, my friend," I said, "they believe in you." And of course, all we can hope on an evening like this is the dead are not assembled. Your dead and mine are not assembled in a dark room in a tropical climate somewhere, overseeing these proceedings and, of course, exercising their right to disbelieve in us.
Narco Disbelief, Stephen Jenkinson and Gregory Hoskins. I had a chance to visit with Stephen Jenkinson by phone from his home in Golden Lake, Ontario, about the origins of Nights of Grief and Mystery, his collaboration with musician Gregory Hoskins and his band.
I kind of heard his name maybe years and years before because he had a bit of a 20-something career, you know, and he came out of the gate hard and fast, and I think that's probably where I heard his name, and then never again for 30 years. So I had a vague sense that, you know, and this is an awful thing to say, but he used to be somebody, right? And of course, you're always somebody. But anyway, from what I knew, I had nothing to offer him. He wanted to talk to me about, I guess, art making, you might say, or something mm-hmm. in that order. And I don't consider myself a practitioner in that area. So I kind of gently protested and suggested his time could be better spent elsewhere. And he didn't listen to me. And he insisted on coming anyway. He said he'd, you know, read the books, and he, as far as he was concerned, I was in the same ballpark as, well, I guess as him. That was it. That's the slender thread that the whole thing hung upon. And at the end of the meeting, you know, I liked the guy. I didn't have a sense of his work. He didn't speak very much. And I guess I did. And at the end, I just hoped that he got what he came for. And he assured me that he did, and on his way out, he left the CD. And I guess that was, looking back on it now, that was a signal moment because I dreaded listening to it, frankly, because, you know, there's so many vanity press CDs out there, just like books, the same thing. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's all well and go ahead and do it. But it's, you know, you are in competition with some of the heavyweights if you're using the same format and the same art form. Yeah. You know, and, you know, fair's fair. So anyway, eventually about a week or two into it, I kind of listened because it was bothering me sitting there on the shelf unaddressed. And I was I was just knocked out, almost right out of the chute. And my first thought was, I wished I had known that this is what this guy was capable of, you know, with no label support, no brewery support, no support of any kind, that he was still had his hand, his iron in the fire, mm-hmm. that deep into a lifetime with no sort of marketplace encouragement to do so, absolutely captivated me and staggered me. And I guess his example claimed me, if you will. And then when he suggested, you know, the possibility of doing something, though I couldn't for the life of me imagine what it would be, and I really had to step outside of what I was comfortable with and familiar with to include somebody, because I'd been on mm-hmm. on the stage for years by myself entirely, partly by default and partly by design. And the notion that I was going to try to fabricate something in alliance with someone on the spot was so dumbfounding and frankly undoing that it seemed like my kind of work.
Ah.
and that's what we did. And I just remember the parking lot, loading up his stuff into the van after the first thing that we had ever done together. And I just looked at him kind of impulsively and I said, I think there's something here. I think something could happen. And he mumbled, as is his wont. And I took that as an affirmation, or as close I was ever likely to get. Uh-huh. And I got this grant from an American foundation that they just wanted my work to be more well-known in the United States. And they proposed funding a tour. So I just swiveled around. I looked at him and said, look, man, I got this money. I got these gigs. I was going to do it by myself. What do you think? And we literally fabricated Nights of Grief and Mystery on the spot, with our first real gig being in New York City before a sold-out house. And the next was, I think, Boulder, and then Points West and Austin. And it was nuts. I mean, we were in one of those places every night and traveling during the day, which, of course, is supposed to kill younger people, but seemed instead to authenticate this kind of nerviness that the two of us had come up with. I must say that the presumptuousness of it is not very Canadian, and I think our citizenship was in disrepair when we took it upon ourselves to do this kind of thing.
Well, have we got a strange gig file?
In 100 meters,
go in
the roundabout, take the third exit and stay on Oakland Road.
Oh man, I had to mine my own soul tonight, because I had nothing coming back.
In 600 meters,
the glory.
Well, this life on the road, you know, wondering about these kind of things and all the slings and arrows that ensue, and not that easy on the chassis, and not that easy on the soul either, if I can be honest with you. And I've been out a long, long time. You know, you come to a theater and they claim they have a green room, or at least you have to ask for one. Sometimes it's not green, and sometimes it's not a room. And in Fishguard, it was neither. And they led me up the stairs, which were just stage left, up the stairs, and there was a perch up there, big enough for one chair. And it was a platform that invited you to plummet. That's all it was. You literally got up and you had to turn around and sit in the chair like that and face the stairs you just come. Perhaps something like an execution, I'm not sure. But I went up there and I sat down, and I was woe begone, because I was in that condition that you can get sometimes when you've been with strangers for a long time and you've been troubled aloud and nobody's been asking you to do so, and perhaps you've been tolerated, perhaps you've been applauded a time or two, but for all of that, you're a long, long way from home, and you are forever a stranger in a strange land. And that's the shape I was in that night, and I was wondering, man, where's it going to come from? It was me. I had no band. I had no band. I had no supporting, no companion, no compatriot. I just me and my weathered, wearied self. And I sat there and I pretty much prayed out loud. I said, you know, give me a sign. Give me a sign. I don't need exactly yes or no. I just need a okay, or carry on, or something. Or if the indication is the otherwise, let me know too. I can get the people their money back and take the first plane back, and then try to account for myself when I get back home. Nothing. No nothing. Man, you can be lonely with people filing into a theater waiting to hear from you. You can. At least I was that night. And I sat up there and I wondered what was to become of me, not just that night, but at all. And I wondered, had I made, as they like to call it now, good decisions for myself? And I was under-persuaded. And I sat there waiting for the sign, and there was no sign. And then before I know it, the stairs at the bottom of that little gangplank opened. Excuse me, the door at the bottom opened. And I thought, gee, this is it. It's come all too soon, like all the endings do. It's come way too soon. And I didn't get enough information, but now I gotta stand and deliver or fail. Who knew? Something asked me to pause ever so slightly and wait to be called, but nobody called me. And this person didn't say anything. The door closed. They were still there because I could hear them shuffling. And then I heard them speaking, but they weren't speaking to me. And I realized this person's ducked into this little stairwell to have a private conversation, which they are now not going to have. And I sat up there and, like you, I listened. I didn't mean to listen, as you wouldn't have done, but there wasn't much distraction that night. And so I listened. And this is what I heard. And he said, "No, no," he said, "it's tonight. No, no. I know the tickets are expensive, but I've set one aside for you. No, you don't owe me anything back for it, because that's how much I want you to come." No, no, he said, "this is the guy I've been telling you about." And I'm thinking. And then he said, "anyway," he said, "if you understand something about what he's about, I think you and I have a chance." I'm thinking to myself, don't put me in the middle of your romance, man. Especially not tonight. If the whole thing's riding on how I'm doing, you don't have a chance, man. Don't, you know, back away from me while you still can, you know. But anyway, I didn't want to break the spell. And anyway, I was more a little curious where this was headed. And he said, "no," he said, "you got to come tonight. And here's why," he said. "Because he'll be dead soon." And that's how I found out that I'm going to die.
Stephen Jenkinson and Gregory Hoskins with "Dead Soon." The other half of this collaboration is musician, songwriter, guitarist, and singer Gregory Hoskins. Hoskins' career spans 11 recordings over 27 years and record deals on 3 continents. Hoskins' lyrics and voice tend to break and bind at the same time in songs that are steeped in beauty and a muscular type of sorrow. He does it over propulsive grooves, brooding electric guitar work, and rich sonics. He and the band use those sonic textures to underpin Jenkinson's readings, too, using swirls of drums, bass, guitar soundscapes, and synth pads, along with vocal harmonies, trumpet, and live looping. With Gregory Hoskins in the band, Stephen has offered nights of grief and mystery to sold-out houses on 3 continents. I spoke with Gregory by phone in his home studio, where he was preparing for a Nights of Grief and Mystery tour. I asked him how he approaches the musical tones and flavors to support Jenkinson's reading for the performances.
We are couching all of this stuff inside of something that looks like, doesn't quite act like, but kind of looks like a rock and roll band. And I play electric guitar. I mean, I didn't grow up doing that, but I've been playing electric for the last, you know, maybe 10 years or so, and meaningfully for the last 5 years. And a lot of that has to do with working with Stephen.
I find that very interesting, because I think that that is a very so much a part of what's happening artistically. The medium, using an electric guitar. The electric guitar in and of itself has a definite connotation to people, and it seems like, in a way, that's a really strong method of connecting with an audience with subject matter that is challenging to a lot of folks.
An electric guitar treated properly gives you a lot of atmosphere at your fingertips, so there's that. But could you imagine, given people make assumptions, or most often with this particular thing, they don't really know what to expect. But if they saw an old white guy like me trot out onto stage with an acoustic guitar, it would be difficult. If I was in the audience, it would be difficult to stay, because then the assumption I'd be making was I was about to hear a lot of really shitty folk music behind this guy talking. So the actual, you know, the appearance of the electric is like you said, is that it's about as modern as we get. Could we do this thing around a fire pit? Yeah, we could. Could I do it on acoustic? Absolutely, I could, for sure. But we choose to use electricity. You know, we depend on this AC thing, and it's ironic considering Stephen lives off the grid. But I think that there's something poetic in the relationship between the fairly modern approach and the instruments and the subject matter at hand, which of course goes back a long, long, long way, you know, predating, well, basically to the beginning, if, you know, if we're talking about death.
Mm-hmm, so, right.
You know, kind of predates fire. And so it's an interesting mix of two things, I think.
Gregor, one of the other things that really strikes me and stands out in listening to recordings of this collaboration is the interspersing of your voice as a singer and bringing your original songs to this collaboration.
I can't remember how it came about. I think we just both understood that he did what he did and that I wasn't really a guitarist. You know, I was a songwriter and a singer. I think we just felt like it was proper. And then it was also, it started to get interesting to see where the intersections were between his work and my work. And the fact is that when he picked up my CD after I'd left it for him, after a few days after I'd left the farm, that first time we met, and the first tune on that record is something, is a song called Take a Little Walk. What he heard in it was immediately for him was something that captured his attention. As it often is in songs and songwriting, what the listener hears is not exactly what the writer intended. And that's true here too. For him, it was something that seemed to sum up a lot of his time in the death trade and watching people die. That was the first song that I started to play, and then I think we were curious as to where other intersections might happen. We just kind of look for some secret code that exists between the two things, and then we put them together. And I don't think they don't need to make sense. They need to feel right.
I'm gonna take a little walk through them fields. Gonna carry me gently for my heart to heal. Gonna find me a demon in a dark, dark wood. You can't come with me, I wish you could. When I was born, when I was raised, I was loved and I was praised. When I got scared, my mama did arm me with a cross and a prayer to keep harm from me while I take my little walk through them fields. Carry me gently for my heart to heal. Gonna find me a demon in a dark, dark wood. Can't come with me, I wish you could. The prayer brought comfort for a while. I brought comfort to leave me as his comfort style. The cross I gave to my girlfriend. I've been thinking about you, Catherine from Welland. While you take your little walk through them fields, I'm gonna carry me gently for my heart to heal. I'm gonna find me a demon in a dark, dark wood. Can't come with me, I wish you could.
Gregory Hoskins performing Take a Little Walk. We'll be back with more of our special program, Grief and Mystery, here on Montana Public Radio. Welcome back to our Montana Public Radio special program, Grief and Mystery.
My father is an orphan, yes. He is dying soon. My My father's an orphan. He is dying soon. I am reminded one day I'll be an orphan too. I will be an orphan too.
Lawrence Duncan has been a practicing music thanatologist in Missoula, Montana, for over a quarter of a century. Music thanatology is a very specific method of providing music to aid in the process of dying, both the person dying and to their loved ones present in the room when that person is dying. Lawrence has been involved for some time with the Orphan Wisdom School and offered some insights into how he came to the work of Stephen Jenkinson.
The first thing I ever heard from Stephen Jenkinson was a video called The Skill of Brokenheartedness. And I must have listened to that. And I listened to that a number of times. I felt a resonance with what he was saying because of what I had found actually playing music by a composer named Peter Dunoff, who is Bulgarian. And the melodies evoked something that really felt appropriate for the work that I was doing. And so then I hear this man talking about brokenheartedness as a skill. It wasn't a huge leap for me to think that might be the case, because I'd already been having experiences at the bedside with people and how this particular kind of modality would just deepen the whole thing. And so that's kind of my way of talking about that first experience of listening to what Stephen had to say.
Lawrence, why do you think this is an important collaboration, this type of an event, the Nights of Grief and Mystery?
Well, I think on the surface of it, it's accessible. It's a way for Stephen to be himself, to be a faithful witness and talk about his experiences and tell the stories which are so needed. I mean, there's just no medium like, I mean, you, John, are really good at this. It's storytelling. And what can be conveyed telling a story is so...
It's so primal, right?
Well, there you know? Are. That
you go back to the origins of humanity and when speech was developed and, you know, eventually we began to tell each other our stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. And as my experience at the bedside playing music for people, there is this possibility of it helping deepen the experience.
I'd like you to speak a little bit more to the idea of it being an important thing at this time.
My experience in hospice tells me that we could do better. And I really feel it's true that we need to allow dying to be in the room. The common language in the world of hospice is quality of life. But Jenkinson rightly raises the question, well, what about quality of death? So that's part of it, but there's very much more that Stephen has to offer. And again, I think the short answer to your question is, you know, what is imposing itself upon our individual and joint psyche in this particular troubled time we're living in calls upon us to get skilled at grief. The hard thing for us, I think, in our time is that it's too painful to really learn what we need to learn. And that's, for me, what this idea of grief as a skill is. You get good at hearing what you don't want to hear and knowing what you don't want to know, learning what you don't want to learn. Our culture is so good at providing us distractions from doing it. You don't want to think about that? Fine, think about this. No culture in history has been as good at not paying attention as we are. So Stephen Jenkinson has a school, the Orphan Wisdom School. And we, you know, do our best to put ourselves in that position of learning things we don't really want to learn, that we'd rather not have to learn. And I think that's what I want more people to be exposed to, that kind of an idea.
I'd like to tell a story to all the men here.
That's how you learn about old. You learn about old by learning about not young.
I don't mind if anybody else overhears, mind you.
There's such a thing as not young. You'd be glad of it, that your youth is finally done. You don't have to do that crazy shit anymore. You get to do old person crazy shit. Much different repertoire.
But this is for the men.
There's a mournful little event that happens in the life of a young boy. It doesn't seem to get nearly the kind of attention I think it deserves. And it's this. You were adrift in the amniotic funk of your mother for the longest time. That's not the mournful part. The mournful part is when you are expelled. And you are expelled. It's not your idea. You're trying to figure out what did you do wrong. You're 3, which is a deeply achieved age by then. And you're following the rules as best as you can figure them out, though they are a bit of a moving goalpost from time to time, but still. And for all of that, suddenly somebody decides, and you get the message, that the bath time thing has changed. And you are expected now to do so on your own. What a mysterious thing. Something like being excommunicated. You're trying to find the reason why, and nobody tells you. And then there's a certain familiarity that goes by the wayside with that woman that you've known for so long, your entire life at least. And she doesn't let you as close in the same way as she wants it. You know what I'm talking about, of course, but I'm telling it from the kid's point of view. And again, nobody explains it. Nobody says this is good for you. And if they did, it wouldn't mean anything anyway. What's wrong with the bath? The good old bath, you know. So time goes by, you see, and eventually you're banished from any real alertness to your mother's physique. This is one of the great losses for a young boy turning into something flirting with the beginnings of manhood. So confusing. That kind of love is so confusing. No guidebook, no explanation, and it sure doesn't look like love. And time goes by, and you get used to it, and apparently this is called growing up. You scab over that place, and then apparently you heal over, or you get a bunion on it, whatever it is. And it's the least sensitive place in you from then on. And that's the reward system. You feel that the least, and this apparently is a good sign that you're getting on with your life. And time goes by, and maybe something like this happens if you're lucky enough to live long enough. That your mother's admitted to the hospital for who knows how many times. In my mother's case, she was of the first generation of women who could smoke in public without opprobrium following the war. And she did. And she exercised that right to the full, and she smoked and smoked. And she sent me to the store for her cigarettes, and I used to argue with her, as you would have done and probably did do. But it was legal in those days for a kid to pick up his mother's cigarettes, and I did. And of course, she's eventually diagnosed with emphysema. And of course, that's what she died of. But you don't know that yet. Because you can get used to these chronic hospitalizations the way you can get used to almost anything, including being excommunicated from closeness to her. So I went in for my, you know, duty of visit. And I walked to the room. And the door was open. And the bed was empty. And it was nicely made. And her chart wasn't there. By this time, I was working in the business. I went to the front desk, and I got the nurse's attention. I said, Mrs. Jenkinson, should I know anything? They said, oh, yes, she's been transferred to such and such a ward. I said, oh, really? Why is that? They said, well, they're better able to care for her there. Now, she's admitted with emphysema. This is a pulmonary care facility, and she's being discharged to someplace more able to care for her. And I looked at the woman, and she wouldn't look at me. I looked at her, and she still wouldn't look up. And I made myself say something that I never in a million years imagined I'd say. I said to her, you've decided that she's palliative, haven't you? And that's what this means. And that's when she looked up at me and she said, yes. And that walk from that station to my mother's room, I tried to change my mind as to where in her life I was. Because when it comes to your parents, it's always you first, isn't it? Of course it is. It's my mother I'm talking about. Where in her life am I? And by the time I got there, I couldn't make that. I couldn't turn the corner. And I walked in. And by this time, she was what they call in the business unresponsive, which means we're never going to talk again about anything. She was heaving because she was breathing from up here now. And the nurses were suctioning her and so on. It was a grim, grim time. And I stood there, and fortunately there was nobody else there. And in that moment, all of those years and all of that excommunication washed over me for the last time. And I looked at her like I'd never done before because she couldn't look back. And I'll tell you, I did. I looked down. And I looked to that place where I came into the world from. And I'd never looked at it in 40 years. Oh, she was still all clothed and everything, of course. But I looked there, and I knew that to be as close to home as I would ever have. And how is it in our life that we draw closest to home as it draws away from us? And that's how it was in that moment. And I looked at her, and I saw then how she was truly, among many other things in this life, but she was the canoe that bore me into this world. With her heaving rib cage and her uncertain spine and all the other aspects of canoedom that she had. If you've ever seen a canoe with no one in it out in the water, it's a disturbing sight. Something's really wrong when you see that. But for all of that, if a canoe is out there, no one in it, and the wind has it, it's a fitful, turning thing. But when the canoe is in the current, it moves very faithfully, not all the twisting and turning at all, born as it seems bearing must be. And that's when I knew that canoe is leaving, and is leaving without me.
Stephen Jenkinson, Gregory Hoskins, and the band performing Mother Canoe. More of my interview with Stephen Jenkinson here, speaking to what this collaboration is and isn't, one being a concert about dying. To be clear, that's what Jenkinson says it is not.
Some people want it to be exactly that. I guess there's a handle that they can wield if, quote, that's what it is. But it remains to be seen what it is because, you know, the given concert hasn't happened yet. I mean, I've done a lot of them, but they don't determine what happens the next time. Of course, we have a set list, which I call a sequence of allegations. And then we are obedient to the next 2.5 hours rather than its master. Most people don't know what this thing is, and that's having seen it. You know, they'll come to me in the book signing lineup afterwards, utterly dumbfounded by something they just participated in. So rather than going, oh, I get it now, they said, you know, I came here with no expectation and no idea of what it was, and I leave here with less of an idea of what it was than when I came here with. And it's called Nights of Grief and Mystery for a reason. You know, it's not, it doesn't call it Nights of Grief Resolved and Mystery Unveiled. I mean, the grief and the mystery sure. is intact at the end of the evening. So how could you possibly call that a concert by the normal understanding of the term? And I think probably the better term to use would be something like ceremony. To engage things at that level, the word ceremony seems to belong.
Stephen, when I asked about the event not being a concert about dying, I find it interesting that what I was trying to get at was the about dying part, and
oh,
you
know.
Went to the concert part, which is and where I wanted to go with this was the concept of humor not being the opposite or opponent of grief, but a companion. Just love that.
I love it too, I guess. You know, people will come up to me in that same book signing lineup and they'll say, well, that was amazing and everything. And I say, thanks very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it and I'm glad you took the time to let us know. But you know what they said? And I would say, what? They say, you're funny. In that tone of voice, like, it's the least likely thing. As if something called grief and mystery automatically banishes mirth. I mean, anybody who's been alive for longer than several days knows full well that our operation is so crazed so much of the time that you realize humor, it's not a coping strategy. Humor is sanity. This is wondering aloud about things and finding in the times that we're in deep reasons to be alive, as well as challenges to being alive. Of course that's there, but you'd kind of expect that. What you might not expect is how deeply life-affirming the ability to laugh is. And when the audience laughs, you know, I love it. So we're very lucky that a good amount of this thing seems to generate a kind of nervous, uncertain laughter. It's a laughter that doesn't know if it's allowed or not.
I should tell you that this is a true story. And it really happened, too. And that's a useful distinction to make, friends. I'm surely you've had the experience that there are true things that you're still waiting for that haven't happened. And there's quite a few things that have happened that probably, even so, aren't true. Well, this is true, and it happened. And I remember it well. Phone rang. I went over to the phone, as I'm wont to do. I picked it up. And I risked it all, and I said, hello. Because you never know. And the person on the other end of the phone broke the code of reciprocity. And they said, oh, like that. And in a moment like that, you're not really sure any longer about much. And finally, the person said, I didn't think you'd answer the phone. And so I was obliged to say, well, if it rings, generally that's what I do. In fact, everybody here at the house answers the phone if it rings. On the other hand, if it doesn't ring, we just leave it alone. Poor thing. Sits there quietly more often than not. But for all of that, my compassion doesn't ebb out over the telephone, so I just leave it to its own devices, so to speak. And she said, oh, God, like that. And I said, wrong number. And she said, and I said, why don't we do this? Should we start again? What do you say we start again? And she said, could we? And I said, we can. Or as my daughter would say, we completely can. So I said, here we go. Now, don't dial again, okay? We'll eliminate that part, and I'll just, are you ready? And she said, oh, jeez, like this. It's just too humiliating, right? Anyway, I said, hello? And she said, oh. I said, no, this is the part where you say, well, you're calling. You remember? You remember this was your idea. Do you remember that? Do you remember when you thought I was a good idea? Do you remember that? Seems like a long time ago now, and I don't know what to do. I can't recover your faith in me. If you ever had any. However, what can I do for you? She said to me, well, she said, I'm a palliative care nurse. And at that moment, I knew an awful lot about her because I worked with palliative care nurses every day. And I did know what that work did to them on the job. And I had a pretty good idea what it did to them off the job too. And as gorgeous and as fulfilling and as deepening as that job was for so many of them, it was harrowing, and it was heartbreaking, and it was hard to believe in, more often than not. I knew all of this, suddenly. I said to her, okay. And then she said to me, well, I've seen you out there, and I've heard you talk, and I've read the things you've written, and I made a promise to myself years ago. I promised myself then, when it was my turn, I'd call you. In my line of work, my turn generally means only one thing. So I said, okay. Is there anything more I should know? She said, that's about it. So now I stand in the middle of someone's ebbing life. That's a moment when I'm not sure there's anything, such thing as readiness so much as proneness. And I was prone to the fact that I was in close with somebody I might never meet at a desperate and sorrowing time, you see. So she said, that's it, I got nothing else. And I said, okay. I said, here's what we're gonna do. I believe that you calling me, telling me these things, you got somebody at home. I don't think you're telling him, at least you haven't told him yet, you're telling me instead. And you got some kids from the first marriage, they don't know this either. This is kind of fresh. And you're trying it out over here. I said, how am I doing so far? And she said, how do you know all that? I said, did you call me because you thought maybe I know something worth knowing? And she said, I did. I said, well, there you go. She said, okay, here's what we do. I don't know how you're going to get him in the car without telling him why. But one way or another, you're going to have to, because I'm not going to see you by yourself. So you have to bring him. You can bring the kids later if it comes to that. But for now, the two of you come to the farm. Here's the directions. We'll meet all day long. You'll go home at night. And we'll see what we can do. And she said to me, but you would do that. And I said, yeah, I would do that. And she said, why? I said, same reason you called me. If you know the reason you called me, then you know the reason that I'd do it. And that was it, and 2 days went by. Early in the morning, the phone rang again. I picked it up, and I said, hello. And she said, it's me. I said, yes, it is. She said, I just got all the test results, the ones I didn't have when I called you. I said, yeah. She said, they all came back negative. Everyone. Imagine that there's a time in your life when you'd be thrilled to be called completely negative. Because that is such a time. Or even worse, to be characterized as completely normal. If you have ever had a hankering after normal, it's when your nether parts are being scrutinized by the pros. So she said that, and there was a real silence. I mean, a real silence, not just an absence of things said, but a different order of quiet between two people. And I don't know, maybe it was 5 seconds or maybe it was 10, but somewhere in there she began to cry. And then she didn't cry for very long because it kind of escalated. And before I knew it, probably before she knew it, she was keening. If you've ever heard anyone keen, it's another order of humanness, it seems to me. And it's an immense achievement, but it is so hard on the chassis. I think humans can only do it for really a brief period of time, a little burst. And then you're done somehow. And it's had its way with you. And so she came back down to weeping and then to sniffling and then to sort of breathing hard, as you would after going through that kind of strain and that kind of realization. And what's the etiquette of a moment like this with someone you haven't met? Many people would be challenged to somehow intervene and cut it short because there's something wrong. Or if you've been in the death trade for a while, you begin to realize there's almost nothing ever that's wrong. Not because everything's okay, but because most of dying is mandatory. So after a moment, I said to her, do you know why you're crying? And she said, I have no idea. I said, may I? Which is a good thing to ask. May I? And she said, please. And I said, do you know when you called me 2 days ago, you were dying. You didn't think you were dying. You weren't afraid you might be dying. You were. You knew all the signs, just like I do. And you had them. And you were dying. And that brought to you and to your life and to your measured days a kind of clarity that you would never have sought for yourself, a kind of blistering willingness to see regardless of the expense. And you saw a lot. One of the things that let you do is work up the nerve to call and ask for what you knew not. And 2 days ago, you had all of that. This morning, they've taken all of that from you. And it's gone without a trace. And you can scramble. You can try to pretend. You can try to remember. But minus the certainty of the ending of your days, you're now obliged to join the rest of us, the walking wounded, those for whom all endings are merely lifestyle options. Those of us who are certain that we get a vote on every important ending that may or may not be waiting for us. And now, everyone who knew you knows nothing about you.
Stephen Jenkinson and Gregory Hoskins with Dying Nurse. My last interview clip with Stephen features a question about his own feelings about coming to the end of an evening of sharing his stories and thoughts with Nights of Grief and Mystery. Is it hard to let go of the experience for you as a part of that? You know, like when the evening is over.
Yeah. Well, I'm up till 2 or 3 every night. And I'm the only one in the band who is, so maybe that's the answer.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very much so. I look for something to do for the longest time. And it's not really adrenaline, you know. It's a sense of deep arousal. And I'm very lucky to have this affliction, I have to tell you. And with that, I have to depart, I believe, because demands are being made upon me as we speak.
Truly, thank you so much for your time and safe travels. I look forward to seeing you.
Very good, man. I'll see you too. Thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Could it be then that the miracle of life now includes this? And could it be that your dying husband, who won't see 30 years of age, is the miracle that you are seeking? The only one so far in your life together that you've overlooked. It's not easy to say that to a fellow human being at a time like that. But it comes down to, what do you owe people? Not what do they want from you. More, what do they deserve? Thank you for the gift of your evening.
I'm gonna take a little walk through them fields.
This is John Floridus, and you've been listening to Grief and Mystery, a special program exploring the collaboration of Stephen Jenkinson and Gregory Hoskins. Special thanks to Stephen Jenkinson, Gregory Hoskins, as well as Lawrence Duncan and James Novak for their help in the making of this program. Grief and Mystery has been a production of Montana Public Radio.
You can't come with me. Wish you could.